KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Six.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. How did radio adapt to the rise of movies in Hollywood? Katie Sewell's going to explore that topic later this hour in her radio retrospective. We're going to hear a rebroadcast of a conversation with writer Susan Orlean and some culinary advice from food writer Sarah Dickerman. The Seattle School Board recently described itself as the poster child for a dysfunctional school board. So why would anybody want to be part of that? Well, six people are vying for two open school board positions. And here to talk more about the candidates and the jobs they seek is KUOW education reporter Anne Dornfeld. Thanks for coming in. And before we talk elections, did they really describe themselves as dysfunctional?
One anonymous member of the school board made that remark in the self-evaluation this year.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's if that's a unanimous assessment of their abilities, but yeah, it hasn't been, one big happy family, that's for sure.
Is it the root of it personality clashes? Why? What has been dysfunctional about the board?
Definitely seems to be personality clashes. It's might change this after this election, because two of the main people who have been clashing have been Kay Smith Blum and Michael DeBell. They are both leaving their posts. I sat in through one committee meeting, and at one point, Michael DeBell turned to Kay and called her out for sending emails during the meeting and asked her if she'd please not do that. And she turned bright red and looked down at the table, and I kind of wanted to be anywhere but there at that moment. And I can only imagine how often things like that went on. If that was just one little glimpse, which I know that it was,
Weren't they both officers of the school board?
Right. She was president this year and he was the last president. So,
wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they're gone.
They're on their way out.
So those are the two open seats. There's actually three directorships that are up for election, right?
Right, and Betty Patu is running unopposed for a second term. Michael DeBell is stepping down after two terms, and Smith Blum is stepping down after one term.
Now, this is a primary election. What voters will actually see these candidates in August?
In the primary, you only get to vote for any open seats in your district. So there will only be three districts that will be voting and only two opposed. But in the general election, everyone gets to vote at large for all of the open positions.
Well, so let's talk about Michael DeBell's seat first. He is represents, I think, a portion of Northwest Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that is Ballard, Queen Anne area. And there are three people running for that. There's Suzanne Dale Esty, Dean McColgan, and Sue Peters. And the race really appears to be between Dale Esty and Peters. They're the only ones who are actively campaigning, the only ones who've raised any money. And they both have kids in the district. They have that in common. But their politics are a little bit different. Suzanne Dale Esty has an economic consultancy business, and she was most recently the economic development director for the city of Renton. She was actually a student representative on the school board in Seattle when she was in high school.
Wow.
She says that she's always dreamed of being a full-fledged board member, if you can imagine that. Everyone has their dreams. Sue Peters is a writer, and she was one of the founding members of a national organization called Parents Across America that opposes a lot of some of the mainstream education reforms that we've been seeing these days across the country, like charter schools and high-stakes standardized testing. Dean McColgan is actually the one with a political background. He was a city council member on Federal Way and the mayor for a time, but he's been quoted as saying that he's not going to campaign unless he makes it to the general.
We're talking with Anne Dornfeld. So that's the Northwest, the seat that's currently held by Michael DeBell, who is retiring from the school board. Who are the candidates for Kay Smith Blum's seat?
They are Stefan Blandford and LaCrease Green and Olu Thomas. And We only have one candidate in that race who's raised any money, and that's Blanford. He recently got a PhD in education, leadership, and policy studies at the UW, and he's been doing consulting work for local school districts. Lucrece Green has run for school board before, but talking to her, she doesn't seem to have a lot of current knowledge about the district or board issues going on today. She seems to be a few years behind in that. And Olu Thomas is a parent and a former social worker. She's not been very visible in the race. And I interviewed her, but I know other people who've tried to get a hold of her haven't been able to. So she's not a real active candidate.
We do have more specific information about all of these candidates at our website. You could go to kuw.org/elections, and you can find out a few more details if you want about things like college degrees and all the nitty-gritty. Are there certain community groups that are behind certain of these candidates? In other words, we've got a heavy sort of business community effort to reform schools that's been ongoing in the Seattle area. We also have, as you mentioned, there's one of the candidates who is sort of running counter to charter schools and standardized tests. And there are there's a significant number of people in the community as well who really would like to see the Seattle School District move away from that. We saw that with the teacher strike at Garfield over implementing the measures of academic progress tests, an issue that you covered pretty extensively. I guess what I'm asking, are you seeing factions backing certain of these candidates, like one is the business candidate, one is the sort of grassroots candidate?
Right. The most competitive race is race for DeBell's seat, and that's between Dale Estee, McColgan, and Peters. And it's, as I mentioned, mostly between Dale Estee and Peters. And Dale Estee is getting more of the business support. She's getting community groups too, but Sue Peters is getting, has more of the kind of grassroots standard ed reform backers and people who want to get rid of that, the standardized testing, and want to see more effort, more focus placed on involving families in decision making at the district level.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned one of these candidates said this was her dream all along since high school. It's not a job. I mean, it is a job, but this isn't, people don't do this for the money, as I understand it.
No. It is an unpaid position. You get, you know, small stipend for some expenses, but no, it's a lot of work. And, you know, you could look at it as a starting point in someone's political career or just some kind of perversion. But, you know, I was thinking of this Dickens quote, and that is that a wonderful fact to reflect upon, that every human creature is constituted to be that profound secret and mystery to every other.
And that's what it would be to run for school board. I suppose if you felt so passionately about education that this is your way of having some involvement and some sort of power, I suppose, in helping to guide the state's largest school district.
Right, absolutely. I mean, you can understand the reasoning, but I think anyone who sat through a school board meeting would, you know, really seriously question the logic and you know, you're voting on roofing contracts, and it's not all really interesting deciding what the math curriculum is going to be.
I neglected to ask, Kay Smith Blum, I believe, represents an area in the central part of Seattle, correct?
Right. Capitol Hill, central area, downtown, et cetera.
So essentially, voters in August in that area and in sort of Queen Anne, Ballard area, those are the only, and Betty Patu's southeast Seattle constituents, those are the only voters who are going to see any of these names on the August 6th ballots that they've received.
Right. And everyone will see the top two candidates, or in Betty Patu's case, the top one candidate on their ballot come November.
Betty Patu will appear, even though she's going to win the primary, with, you know, more than 50-some percent of the vote, I'm assuming.
You know, I may be
wrong. We'll check that one out. But in any case, we really appreciate you coming in and talking about candidates. But you have uncovered another story this week, which is equally interesting, that the district is paying out $29 million to settle cases involving sex abuse.
Not paying out necessarily. They are facing $29 million in claims and settlement demands from the victims or alleged victims of sex abuse. In one case, a former teacher, now deceased, with the district, and in another case, a student who was a registered sex offender and going to Roosevelt High School.
And that's a few years ago that happened.
Yeah, they were both a few years ago, and in both cases, the perpetrators were convicted of sex abuse. So now the question is whether the district was negligent in either of those cases and letting the teacher and student hang out around the other students. And
why did it take so long for these claims to come forward when these are cases that are clearly several years old?
Right. It's hard to say because in one of the cases, it's pretty it's anonymous because they're child victims and the district's not talking about it. So but, you know, there's statutes and the civil cases can take a few years longer. But it would be paid not cash from the district. It would be from the districts, either their self-insurance or their risk pool among other districts. So these are insurance claims that could turn into lawsuits.
How did you find out about it?
You know, it was a funny thing. I was working with the auditor to get some of the background and the latest audit. And there was one document that the district didn't want to hand over and was challenging the auditor and didn't want the auditor to give it to me. And so I asked for a redacted version, and that was what I got. Like a laundry list. And apparently the district has more than 100 pending claims of one sort or another. Some of them are just, you know, employment claims, but yeah, they have their legal work cut out for them.
I'm assuming that this is something that districts around the country see as well, that it's not just Seattle that gets hit with this stuff.
Right. I mean, you know, anytime you employ that many people and have that many, you know, kids that you're responsible for, there's going to be some legal issues involved. So it's to be avoided.
Ann Dornfeld covers education thoroughly for KUOW. Thank you so much for your work and thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
In a minute, hear a conversation with Susan Orlean, author of Rin Tin Tin, The Orchid Thief, and much, much more. That's right around the corner. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
One thorny issue in the immigration debate is how harshly should we treat undocumented immigrants with criminal records?
There are thousands of unique circumstances, and we're dealing with people's lives, which are messy, and people's circumstances, which are not always what they would like or we would like.
Stories of offenses and consequences today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That report airs this afternoon at 3:30 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. 70 degrees and sunny, expecting to reach 82 this afternoon. Overnight, a clear sky with a low of 58. Tomorrow, Friday, a lot like today, but a little cooler. We'll have maybe some morning clouds, and then it's going to be mostly sunny again with a predicted high of 80. 10:20, I'm Bernard Ouellet. Back in the golden days of radio, some radio actors transitioned to film. But they were often stiff on screen because they were so used to standing still and speaking into a microphone. What other challenges were faced by radio actors going into the movies? We'll find out in 20 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. In my mind, Susan Orlean has the dream job. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, where she covers what the magazine calls American culture, which could be anything, I think. She's written books about travels, about the people she's met, about an obsessive horticulturalist, and most recently about the legendary canine TV and film star Rin Tin Tin, actually many Rin Tin Tins. Susan Orlean joins me in the studio today. Welcome back to Seattle.
It's my pleasure to be here.
I was reading on the official website of yours that you always wanted to write long pieces about people who do interesting things, but when you went to the University of Michigan, there wasn't any kind of major in writing things about interesting people who do things.
Right. This was actually Michigan in particular, a great school, but it had one track when it came to being a writer of nonfiction, which was a straight journalism background. And it never interested me. I took one journalism class. I sat in one or two sessions and dropped out.
Wow. But nevertheless, you did go into journalism, sort of.
I did. I got very lucky. I mean, I majored in English, very traditional English literature. Moved to Portland, so right around the corner,
mm-hmm.
the other city in the Northwest.
The smaller one.
And I really didn't know how I could do this job that seemed, there was no clear career path to this dream job that I had in mind. So I had actually, at that point, acceded to my parents' wishes that I go to law school. And I had just said, just give me a year, and then I'll go to law school. Even though my interest in being a lawyer was less than zero. But it seemed like that was what people with English degrees, I mean, frequently that's yes. what people with English yes. degrees did. I lucked into a job at a tiny little startup magazine. My qualifications were that I just came to the interview and I said, you have to give me this job. You have to. I'll do it for free. I just please let me work here. The minute I started writing, I knew it was what I wanted to do.
You were covering the county. This was the Willamette Weekly that you worked for. You were covering the county, and you were turning in stories that were not quite, I think, what your editors had envisioned when they said, you know, Susan Orlean, cover the county.
Right. I think they assumed I'd be doing stories about zoning ordinances and road repair. And my first story on the beat was a piece about amyl nitrite. And that suddenly was appearing in shops all over. And it was kind of the new over-the-counter high. And my editor read it. He said, you know, I really like this story, but what does it have to do with the county? And I said, well, it's taking place in the county. So that was the beginning of the end of my life as a beat reporter. At some point soon thereafter, he said to me, just go do the stories that you're interested in.
So the New Yorker calls your beat American culture, which I imagine is whatever you latch onto. Am I wrong?
It's right. And I feel very, very lucky to have that kind of freedom. You know, I think coming up with story ideas is a huge piece of my job. And that is to find the stories that are not the predictable, obvious stories, but the ones that aren't purposefully obscure or unknown, but stories that to me jump out and reveal something actually very big, even if it's just that they reveal something about human nature. And those are stories that I come up with that I suppose nominally fall into this category of American culture.
Well, most recently you've written about your treadmill desk. I think that's what it's called, treadmill desk. And this is a desk that essentially you're on a treadmill while you're working, right?
Right, yeah. And this was a short, very fun piece that actually the magazine had come to me and said, we're doing an issue about innovation, and we've heard that you have a treadmill desk. And I said, well, I do. In fact, I'm on it right now as we're talking. And so my editor said, can you write just a little piece about it? And it was actually a lot of fun to do. And for the record, I did write it while I was on my treadmill desk, which I felt was meant that it was doubly determined.
We're talking with writer Susan Orlean, and I'm imagining writing on a treadmill desk the same way as, you know, you rub your stomach and pat your head at the same time.
I know.
How can you walk and write?
There are people who probably would fall off, and I'm happy to say I'm not one of those people. It is less of an intellectual undertaking than you might think. The desk is set up so that you walk and you very quickly forget that you're walking and you just do your work. And I love it. I really love it. And this is my second piece that I've written while walking at my desk. You know, this could be my imagination, but in both cases, I was unusually fluid as I was writing. And I wonder whether it's because, you know, you get a lot of nervous energy when you're sitting still. Mm-hmm. And there have been times when I notice that if I'm sitting at a desk and I'm jiggling my legs and I'm tapping the keyboard and I'm chewing gum and I'm sort of burning up a lot of energy.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering also if it was like, you know, a slow endorphin seep. You know, you're not walking fast enough that you're out of breath when you're doing this.
Right.
But when you are moving, you know, if you are a runner, so well, you get an endorphin high.
Absolutely. And it has been studied enough to know that, for instance, people who hold meetings while they're walking are more productive for many reasons, including the fact that they're not sitting face to face in a sort of confrontational way. But yeah. Also, your body, there's something else is going on when you're walking.
I wonder if that's why all those executives go out to the golf course. That just stuck in my head. You wrote in your book.
A golfing desk. That's a new innovation.
I think that would be very, very hard.
Very popular.
For me in particular. But it's an interesting idea. You wrote in the Rin Tin Tin book that the stuff that stays with us and manages to outlive its limits is what drew me to this story. And it's what I wonder about. Is that the basis of anything that you really delve into on this long form level?
Absolutely. I think what my greater curiosity is could be just that real question of how do we manage this mysterious thing called life? How do we figure out what to do with our time and our thoughts and our hearts? What do we care about? What do we make matter? Mm. And what are the stories that drive us? And that ends up being the sort of deeper connection I have with the subjects that I choose.
Well, this book is called Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend, but it's, to my mind, as much about Lee Duncan, who was the discoverer of this little puppy in I think it was a barn, right, in World War I in France, and, you know, a bunch of puppies. He took two of these puppies home. But so it's about all the Rin Tin Tins, because there were many of them. But it's as much about this man.
Absolutely.
I mean, you could have called it, you know, Lee Duncan.
Yeah. I mean, and part of what was fascinating to me is how invisible he was, in spite of having created this international icon that literally everybody around the world knew of. And Lee remained very much in the background. He really sublimated his own need for attention in the interest of promoting the fame of Rin Tin Tin, and that fascinated me.
It was about promoting the fame of his dog, but at some point, I'm not sure if it was you or he, called Rin Tin Tin the love of his life.
Absolutely. And there was something both remarkable and also a little heartbreaking, because he was married and he has a child.
Right? He was married twice.
Yeah. And I would say that some of what fascinated me was that he never really connected with another person, that his emotions were channeled totally to this connection with the dog. And he was a pretty solitary man. And what he found, what connection he found in a sense of being intimate, was just with Rin Tin Tin.
Rin Tin Tin the first.
The first.
Because there were many Rin Tin Tins. Some of them might not have been related to the original Rin Tin Tin. That's part of your quest. But it was that first dog. I think he had subsequent close relationships with other of the dogs. But it was that first puppy that that was the love of his life.
Well, when you think about the circumstances, he was a lonely kid, grew up partly in an orphanage, partly on a huge ranch in Southern California, abandoned by his father when he was a child, goes to war, World War I. He enlists because he wanted to learn how to fly, and, you know, had never traveled anywhere, had never been anywhere, suddenly is in what would arguably be considered the most brutal war the world has ever known. You know, just the shock of it. The the sort of closeness of battle in World War One, I think, is quite different even from what we see in modern warfare.
Right.
I mean, this was hand-to-hand combat. Horrible circumstances. His unit was being decimated not only by combat, by the flu, which there was a huge epidemic of flu. Just a nightmare. In the middle of this, and he had always loved dogs, he finds these puppies. So I think the context makes you understand it's not just that he's this odd, sort of emotionally deformed person, but rather in those extreme circumstances, surrounded by death, a kid who always had been lonely, who always had loved animals, finds these puppies. And that almost saves him. The remainder of the war, he just focused on keeping these puppies alive.
We're talking with writer Susan Orlean. Her most recent book is about Lee Duncan and Rin Tin Tin. And you set off exploring Rin Tin Tin. I imagine you didn't know about Lee Duncan. And it leads me to wonder whether, if it had been just sort of a promoter sort of guy, a crass person, that you would have spent 10 years of your life pursuing this story.
Never. And that was part of what was so interesting, is this was a story that, you know, I was fascinated by Rin Tin Tin because I remembered him from my childhood. I was in love with German Shepherds when I was a kid because of Rin Tin Tin. Mm-hmm. And then when I discovered, purely accidentally, that he had been a real dog, not born in the 1950s, which was when the TV show ran,
right,
but born in 1918. And I thought, what? What? This is crazy. Lee's story was so much more interesting than, for instance, Lassie, who was owned by a dog trainer who had been trained for the movies, who, you know, that, of course, it's an interesting story. But there wasn't this organic tale of, you know, a kid finds a dog and then almost stumbled into Hollywood with him. Really, this was not a commercial project of, let me train a dog for the movies, but rather this was my pet dog that I am intimately bonded with, and he's so smart. I wonder if, I don't know, maybe I could get a job because I have no job otherwise. Maybe I could get him into the movies. I'll go knocking on studio doors. So his story and the arc of how it happened was so interesting and so unexpected. And I really think that had it not been that story, it wouldn't have ended up being a book.
I'm just imagining you pitching this to a book editor. I'm going to write this long book about Rin Tin Tin, and I'm going to spend a decade tracking down.
You never say that when you're pitching a book. You say, I think it'll be really quick. I think I'll be able to have it for you in a year. And then on the 11th month, you say, you know, actually, there's a little more there than I mean, part of it was, I mean, honestly, I kept finding more material. As I began the book, I had no idea that I would find in Riverside, California, 14 huge file boxes of Lee Duncan's papers.
These were in a storage unit that his, was it his daughter that had the key? Some a relative had it.
That was Burt Leonard.
Burt Leonard's key.
So Lee's material was all being thrown out, and somebody saw it as it was being put in a dumpster and said, wait a minute, that doesn't seem right. This is part of my memories of childhood. It seems like, let's save these papers. And she collected them and gave them to the museum in Riverside. But they had basically sat there more or less unnoticed for many, many years.
It seems like it would take a particular kind of personality to do this sort of stalking of the facts. Would you call yourself sort of obsessive, disciplined? How do you describe what it is that it takes to keep going on a story like this?
That's a very good question. There's a kind of determination, I guess, that and a drive And it was very interesting when I was working on The Orchid Thief and I was writing very, very directly about the idea of obsession mm-hmm. and a kind of passion that I found very peculiar. And yet it dawned on me, and it was sort of the big flip in the book, was suddenly thinking, but I'm exactly the same way. Mm-hmm. I look at this as very odd, like, why would anybody be so obsessed with an orchid? Why would someone be so obsessed with Rin Tin Tin? And yet, of course, the great irony is that the entire process of pursuing these stories requires a similar sort of obsession. And in the case of The Orchid Thief, one thing I marveled over is how John LaRoche, the main character mm-hmm. in the book, had an alarming ability to focus intensely on something, be wildly passionate about it, and then be done. Just turn it off, walk away, go on to the next passion. And I thought, how weird. How can anybody do that? Well, of course, the great surprise, you know, the joke was on me because mm. that is the nature of being a writer. You are obsessed and focused with a subject, and then you finish and you move on.
You have a elementary school aged child now, which you didn't for most of your career.
Right.
And how does that play into the kind of focus that you need to be peeking through dusty archives in the Riverside Museum or going to weird storage units where you might get conked on the head because it's dark and scary?
It's huge. It's huge. And it's something that I hadn't really anticipated. I naively assumed that I would have a kid and then, you know, the next day sort of go back to work. Wrong on every account, not only in the mere fact of the amount of time being a parent requires, but the ability to say, I'm going to go dive into these archives and I'll emerge in a week, a month, you know, you name it. That ability to surrender entirely to a story just doesn't exist anymore. And that, you know, a lot of people, there's a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of finger-pointing about why there aren't more women doing long-form nonfiction. And call me a contrarian, but the fact is it's a very hard choice of careers if you're a parent. And being a mother, I think, is different from being a father. Mm-hmm. And this is maybe treading on controversial territory, but I think it's a very difficult thing when you're a mother to say, I'm going to go away for 3 weeks because I'm digging into archives. I'll see you in 3 weeks. I now, first of all, I think about stories before I opt into them and try to think, how much travel will this take? How much time will it take? How much of that kind of focus will it require versus I want to be a good parent. I want to, you know, and I miss my kid mm-hmm. and I want to be with him. I'm working on a new book, and part of the pleasure of it is that I'm living in Los Angeles right now and the book is in LA. There's some amount of travel I'll have to do, but the bulk of it is in LA. And I thought, wow, I can actually do this and still have a normal life. It's a huge problem. And as much as we love the idea of having equality in opportunity, the reality of what it feels like day to day to be a mother and to have work that requires a kind of surrender of yourself, it nobody has solved that problem, and I don't know that they ever will.
It won't be in my lifetime, I don't think. Yeah. Well, we'll look forward open-endedly to that next book. Susan Orlean is a staff writer for New Yorker magazine. Her most recent book is called Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend, which I believe is out in paperback. It's wonderful to have you here again.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. This is Weekday.
Susan Orlean spoke with KUOW's Marcy Silman, and you can hear that interview again at our website, kuow.org. A peek behind the scenes of the golden age of radio in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Powell's Wood, a Northwest garden, presenting a storytelling festival Saturday, July 27th. Guest tellers include Donald Davis, Heather Forrest, and Margaret McDonald, with personal stories and folktales to entertain audiences of all ages. More at powellswood.org/festival.
70 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 82 this afternoon with sun. Overnight, a clear sky, a low of 58. And tomorrow, Friday, maybe some morning clouds, then mostly sunny in the afternoon with a high of 80.
I'm Armin Alney on the next To The Point. From personal satellites to tourism in orbit, space travel is going private. Among big business, entrepreneurs, and Kickstarter, who's making the money? What are the legal challenges? Can extraterrestrial exploration be crowdsourced? Next time on To The Point from Public Radio International.
That conversation slips the surly bonds of Earth 30 minutes from now on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
Now we cast our hearts and ears back to the golden age of radio. How am I doing? As an actor for Golden Age. That wasn't very
good.
Not
so good right now.
That was not a very good announcer for the Golden Age of Radio, which is what we're talking about today. How is it that these people who were, you know, after all, it was a new medium, became better at what they were doing? Or, you know, and how movie stars, maybe they didn't quite cut it. Katie Sewell, producer, hello.
Yeah, last week we talked about how radio wanted the big stars on the air, but they weren't always cut out to be radio actors. They were wandering off the mic. They weren't particularly good at reading their lines and acting with their voices instead of their faces. Well, today we look at the reverse of that.
The ones
radio,
that were good?
Radio actors trying to break into the movies.
Yeah.
So Hollywood decides that they're going to try to capitalize on radio through film.
And who do they pick first? Amos and Andy.
Well, it was one of the earliest ones, 1930. They pick Amos and Andy, which were two black characters that were played by two white men, Freeman Gostin and Charles Cornell. Today we have to consider this show... You know, kind of a racist character.
Kind of a little bit insulting.
Definitely. But in 1930, Hollywood made Amos and Andy movie called Check Double Check.
Now, right here, we're going to have to do some reviving and some reduction. Now, 10 goes in the 12. 10 goes in the 12.
Well, get it in there.
Will you shut your big mouth? Brother Andy, you doing that the old way. Let's do that the new way.
To do it anyway, Kingfish, so if I can tell you, he ain't never gonna get in there.
Now, anybody knows that 2 tens is 20. Now, you take that 12 and you deduct it from the 20, and that leaves 8. And, brothers, $8 is 10% of $12. The new way.
That don't sound right to me, Kingfish. The old way was better than that.
You see, Kingfish, Amos don't know the new way they're thinking nowadays.
Yeah, but the way he got to figure that, we do all the work and he get all the money.
Yeah.
Film made a lot of money.
The film actually did make a lot of money, but most people considered it to be absolutely terrible. The box office numbers were eventually credited just to people's curiosity, wanting to see what the actors actually look like, rather than they're attractive to the film and its plot line. And the actors themselves actually weren't very dynamic on the screen. They were very wooden and had to have a lot of direction from the director to move around and actually have some personality.
Well, they were used to being on the radio. All right, so Hollywood also wanted to adapt some radio plays, the full-length feature films, Sorry Wrong Number was a radio play first, huh?
Yeah, Sorry Wrong Number was one of the most popular radio plays by the show Suspense. It featured Agnes Moorehead as a woman who overhears a murder plot over a crossed phone line and slowly begins to realize that she's the target.
Your call, please.
Operator, I'm in desperate trouble. I
am sorry, I cannot hear you. Please speak louder.
I don't dare. There's someone listening. Can you hear me now?
I am sorry.
Oh, but you've got to hear me. Oh, please, you've got to help me. There's someone in this house. Someone who's going to murder me. And you've got to get in touch with the police. Oh, there it is. Did you hear it? He's put it down. He's put down the extension phone. He's coming up the stairs. Oh, give me the police department. Give me the police department.
One moment, please. I will connect you.
Oh, hurry. Hurry. Oh, hurry. I can hear him. He's coming here. Oh. Oh, no. Oh, what are you going to do to me? Oh, no. Oh, don't come near me. I haven't done anything, please. I don't know anything. Don't.
Martin speaking. Hello, Police Department, Precinct 43, Sergeant Martin speaking.
Police Department?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Must have got the wrong number.
Oh, burn. Agnes Moorehead, man, she was great.
She was amazing. Like, I think she was one of the best radio actresses at the time.
Personally. Worked with Orson Welles?
She worked on it with everybody. Yeah. I mean, she was all over the place. So every radio show, as you all know if you listen, is most of them are usually just a half an hour long. And as was Sorry Wrong Number. So it's just one woman in a house talking to different people on the phone. But of course, that wasn't going to work for a movie. A movie had to be at least an hour, if not an hour and a half. And so they had to add a whole bunch of complex circumstances to the plot when they did the movie version of this, just to fill it out. Like,
so this is a clip from the movie we're
so
in
this
here?
Is a clip from the movie where Barbara Stanwyck was the lead.
What do you know about a man named Waldo Evans?
Waldo Evans? Why? What do you ask?
He called me up tonight. I had a long talk with him just a little while ago. About you.
About me? What about me?
They said you were a criminal, Henry. A desperate man. And Evans said you wanted me to die.
I
didn't mean to be so awful to you, Henry. I only did it because I loved you. And I thought you didn't love me. And that you'd go away and leave me.
Henry, listen to me, Leona. I want you to try to get out of bed. I want you to get out of that bed and walk to the window. I want you to scream out in the street, Leona.
I can't move, Henry. I'm too frightened.
Keep trying. Otherwise, you've only got 3 more minutes to live. Don't talk to me anymore. Just get out of that bed. I confess everything. I did steal from your father. And I was so desperate I even tried.
Henry!
I arranged to have you...
Henry! There's somebody coming up the stairs!
Get out of that bed!
No! No, I can't! Henry!
Man, a nice contrast between radio and movies there, huh?
Yeah, it's very different in the sense that he heroically tries to save her life at the end, but he is not successful. However, a lot of people who saw the movie expressed that they were dissatisfied with it.
Like, yeah, because
it just
it's not
wasn't
in your head.
Satisfying, and it was too complicated. It had all these other characters. And in fact, the author, Lucille Fletcher, said that, you know, in the radio show, you got the feeling that the woman dug her own grave by, you know, being a prisoner of her own house and not calling people enough. And then the more complicated storyline made the movie less effective. So,
yeah, she looked like more of a victim.
But, Steve, there was one realm where radio actors were actually successful on the big screen. But they're still not acting in person. They were acting as the voices of cartoons.
Well, that makes sense.
Bill Thompson played Wallace Whipple in the comedy show Fibber McGee and Molly. Here's a clip.
Oh, she's fine, Mr. McGee.
You mean
Sweetie Face, my dainty young wife.
Your dainty young wife?
I can dream, can't I? She was fixing dinner last night, and I went out in the kitchen, and I said, Sweetie Face, I said, spring is here, the season of romance. Lean down here, I said, and give your little Wally a great big smack.
Oh, you devil, you. Did she do it?
Yes, but I picked a bad time to ask, Mr. McGee.
Oh?
Have you ever been smacked with the flat side of a fresh halibut?
Voice sounds kind of familiar.
Yeah.
For modern listening audiences, I think. And why does it sound familiar? Because he ended up being this character.
Hello, all you happy people.
Droopy the dog.
Droopy dog.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he wasn't the only one from Fibber, McGee, and Molly to become a big as a cartoon character. Arthur Q. Bryan played the character Doc Gamble on the same show, and he went on to be Elmer Fudd.
Oh, Elmer Fudd who am I thinking of?
You're Mel Blanc.
Mel Blanc, thank you.
No.
Oh. You know, John Stewart always imitates Droopy Dog when he's... who's the politician he's being? No, I'm not remembering. Whenever he wants to be a particular politician, he's Droopy Dog. Well, a listener will know.
Yeah.
So they
Hello,
live.
Are you happy people?
That's pretty good.
We should probably make that a regular drop.
John Boehner? Could be John Boehner. I can't remember who. Stewart always is Droopy Dog for this one politician. I can't remember. All right. Shall we do this again?
Yeah, let's do it again.
This is Weekday.
Little breezy music for a sunny Thursday, and this is the day we check in with food writer Sarah Dickerman for a little culinary guidance. I'm up in the ante, Sarah. You are now our cultural and culinary icon and our leader.
I like to hear that.
And you're sending us in search of meat.
Yes, this is a very meaty recommendation. I'll have to have a vegetarian one in the near future. But I'm sending you to an old Pike Place Market classic, the Varian Meats, which is a place that, you know, for years I've gone to pick up, I think it's called Kostler, the smoked pork chop.
Yes.
That's super delicious, would be great on a grill in the summer. But now, fairly recently, they renovated and have a little luncheonette. And you can get lunch there, and it's a fun place to go because you can browse and look at all the gummy candies and the imported mustards and the great charcuterie, and then you can have something like a nice Wiener Schnitzel. And the way they do things, it's just really, sometimes I think context is very important. So Wiener Schnitzel is a thinly pounded piece of meat, in this case pork, that's then breaded and fried, and so it's sort of crispy and thin and yummy, but they serve it up with all sorts of sides. They have a delicious vinegary potato salad and shredded cabbage and also a little cucumber salad. So you feel like even though you're eating this pretty hearty lunch, you've got all these lovely little sides that are made with vegetables, and I think that really makes a big difference in a lunch.
It's your balance there, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
You wrote that you can get something called currywurst.
Currywurst, which is, yeah, a sort of a seasoned hot dog-like creation. And then you can get, of course, you can get a bratwurst. And then they do a Reuben of their own making that has a slightly smokier, it's a very heavily packed, yummy sandwich with a slightly smokier quality than maybe a Reuben you would get at another deli. It just has a sort of lovely smokehouse quality, and they do it on marble rye, so it's very nice to look at, too. And it's like I said, it's just a fun place. Of course, it's crowded if you go to the market at any point. I found inside the Varian Meats, it wasn't too overwhelmingly crowded. And it's just a fun place, and you can pick up something for the grill later on in the evening too.
Well, you mentioned sides, and it is really at this point for us wimpy Northwesterners way too hot to cook. And so some of us want to just have summer salads for a meal. And you are looking back to a cookbook that's actually sitting on my shelf right now.
This is, you know, I grew up in the late 70s and 80s. And in the 80s, there was no one bigger in the food world than Julie Rosso and Sheila Lukens, who created the Silver Palette series. They were New York City caterers who just had a knack for making simple American classics, but with a little twist, using all sorts of ingredients that were quite newfangled at the time, balsamic vinegar and sun-dried tomatoes, and, of course, tarragon chicken salad, which is this very creamy sour cream and mayonnaise-based chicken salad that I have to confess I have such a weakness for. And so this book, The New Basics, is the one they made at the end of the decade, and it's a little bit more of an encyclopedic cookbook than their previous two cookbooks, and it has the big has the tarragon chicken salad, so if you're looking for that, it's in there. But it also has really nice guides to different shapes of pastas and different kinds of salads, you know, lettuces and cabbages that you can use in salads. I find it's a very winning book, even after all these years. Lots of good cold soups for summer and fresh fruit salad ideas, easy cobblers and stuff, nice summery desserts. So it's worth a look, and it's probably something you can find online and used.
Well, yeah, I'll sell you my really ratty copy of it. You keep mentioning that tarragon chicken salad. Is there something else that's sort of a go-to hot weather salad that you think about?
Well, you know, just something as simple as a Caesar salad. Not super creative, but boy, in the right weather, that's exactly what you want. And they have a really nice recipe for that as well.
The book is the New Basics Silver Palette Cookbook, although they have the original Silver Palette Cookbook, which I think is just called Silver Palette, right?
Yes. That's right.
They all have recipes. The New Basic is the big one. And like the more encyclopedic cookbooks, it's divided by courses and types of food. Sarah also recommended Bavarian Meats in the Pike Place Market, newly renovated with a little luncheonette. Sounds fabulous. Hope you enjoy some great warm weather food, Sarah.
Yes, thank you very much.
Sarah Dickerman writes about food for a number of publications, including Slate and Bon Appetit. She's on Twitter, at Sarah Dickerman, and at her website, sarahdickerman.com. And she joins us every Thursday on Weekday. And next week, we're hoping that the weather holds so that we can talk about picnics in particular. So I look forward to that. Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette is steering this big ship. I'm Marcy Silman. Tomorrow, Shelby Earle talks about her music. We're also going to talk about the new studies that have been done on menthol cigarettes. It turns out that they are much worse for people than just non-mentholated cigarettes. Bernard and apparently huge hot sellers. We're going to find out why, who, and how.
Okay. Plus, the news in review.
Oh, well, of course,
since
we can't.
It's Friday morning.
We can't forget that.
It's KOW.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll let you finish.
Nah. KOW's weekday program, I was going to say, airs tomorrow morning from 9 to 11 on KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
On The Next Humankind.
It wasn't because I was a great person. It was because I won the lottery of life. I was born to educated parents who read to me. I had a pretty decent school growing up. And so when I look at it, I thought, it's payback time, John.
An executive quits Microsoft to establish thousands of third world public libraries. I'm David Freudberg. Join us for Humankind.
Tonight at 10:30.
Support for KUOW comes from University Bookstore, an independent bookseller with 9 locations that offer thousands of new and used titles, Husky gear, and gift items. Learn more about upcoming author events and store locations at ubookstore.com.
The American Revolution represents less a turning point than a significant milestone in a journey that began not at Lexington and Concord in the spring of 1775, but in the study circles, public libraries, and useful knowledge societies that took shape in colonial cities and towns almost 50 years earlier.
Historian Jonathan Lyons talks about the Enlightenment that laid a foundation for the American Revolution. Tonight at 8 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Another sunny day here in Seattle, 71 degrees at the moment, expecting. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.